You're listening to The Good.
Don't call me Paino.
The Bad.
Absolute Penis.
And The Rugby.
Folded like a deck chair.
With Paino, Lord and The Husk. I don't know what that means.
Now, where were we? Welcome, everybody. Different choir, same church, some hopefully very familiar hymns for us all to get stuck into. As we say, a very warm welcome to The Good, The Bad and The Rugby. Hopefully not too difficult to work out which one is which, but my name is Alex Payne. It's a very warm welcome. Looking very ice white on show one. The Hoff, how are you, kid?
Do you know what? It's so good to be back. There were some nervous bits there, a little few concerns, but you can't keep a good team down. And I'm very excited to be back with my very, very good friends, all looking well. By the way, before people cut, I haven't gone bald and I haven't put sun in my lid. I was in the south of France.
Lies.
Caught the sun. Pipes are on fire. I'm good. Yeah.
There's definitely some Delalio lemon juice, I think, just in the tips of what you've got left.
Is that what they're is that what they're calling it now? Is it Delalio lemon juice? Stay away from that, I tell you.
Lord Lordingtons, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Very well. Enjoying this weather, being away for a little bit. Got some slight injuries, but we won't go into that right now. But otherwise, strong.
Very nice. There is a lot to come over the next few weeks, months, and hopefully years with a new toy that is The Good, The Bad and The Rugby. I'd love to say sort of what's the news to both of you, but the sad truth is we've probably spent more time on the phone and on Google Hangouts over the last 3 months than I think at any point, certainly than any of us wanted to. What's the plan?
News. Oh, go on. You've had your teeth done.
No, I haven't. No, I haven't.
How to lose a show in 4.5 minutes. What?
How to get everyone losing interest immediately. I have, actually, about 2 weeks ago, I had some serious earthworks in my mouth. I've got about 14 stitches and have had the bolt put in that they can then attach the tooth to. But I actually look like, the Grinch, when the head blows out. I look very like the Christmas Grinch for about two weeks.
So. It's a bit strange that after we put, obviously, the Carole Baskin video out, the amount of people who thought you were the first husband of Joe Exotic.
Whatever it takes. Although, funny enough, I also had a friend who said that they thought that it was the top half of my head and the bottom half of your head, Tins, and someone had bolted the two together. So, you can read into that what you want.
Also, we've had the teeth, but we went to number one podcast in the world without producing a show, and we did a trailer, and we got criticised for the trailer for being too short as the first show. So, all the nauseas, we've started well. Thanks so much for your instant feedback. You still quite haven't figured it out, but The Good, The Bad, The Rugby is where we're at. It was only a trailer, and that went to number one. I can't see this show going to number one with this opening shithouse. Give us a chance. Give us a chance, because we will be back.
What are we going to do? What's the idea?
I think we've always keep hitting the diversities that we've always hit, but I think we want to expand. We want to bring in new guests rolling in bigger and better as we go. And make sure we have fun. And I think we can do whatever we want. That's what we wanted when we set out. And the sky's the limit on us. So we are very good at not planning things. Stumbling across things, I think, is our way of doing it.
Rolling with the punches. Hoff, you're now, you've been a serial entrepreneur for quite some time. I think you've had, you tell me whether you've had more hits or misses. It's quite a gamble, I think, for Tins and I to get into bed with you in the business front. But can we please make this one work?
Yes, very much so. I mean, a bit like Haskell Independent Traders. I pulled up my three-wheeler outside the front and decided that, you know what, we loved making a podcast together. It was so good, we decided to buy into it and set up our own production company because I think we want to take this. And basically, Good, The Bad, The Rugby has always been a show about personalities, about getting to know people, about the not being critical about rugby, not just trying to, there's plenty of other good podcasts who will talk about details. We want to know the people, the stories, from the emotional roller coaster of every show to the highs, the lows, everything in between to find out what goes on. And I think, what better start than having Eddie Jones, the number one man, someone who I owe a lot of my career to, who divides opinion, took England to a World Cup final and narrowly fell short, and who isn't short of a word. And I couldn't be more excited to have him. But hopefully we're going to progress to mini pods, tours. Japan, people loved it. There's a Lions tour coming up. Will you see the three of us in there, The Good, The Bad and The Rugby? I think you will do.
I think a lot of people have also been asking, you know, why are we doing it? What are we doing? I don't think we're trying to try and change the track that much. I don't think we're going to put a lot more glitter on the turd that we are. I think it's always going to be about the guests. It's always about making the people who come on our show the stars and letting them tell the stories that they want to tell. And actually, I'd love to build something as we go that the players feel a real ownership of, and that as much as we're asking them to come on, they're asking whether they can be a part of it. So practicing what you preach is really important. And I hope that, you know, there are loads of people we can help along the way. Then that is exactly what this is going to be all about.
We've covered some pretty difficult issues, from, you know, mental health to, you know, the reinvention of the season. I actually love the fact that Tins's plan with all the draft system and everything else
actually picked up quite a bit, actually.
yeah, I think I
don't know, feeling plagiarised in some ways.
I would. Fucking World Rugby, IRB, whatever it's called now. They've got fingers in the till. Oh, but first few minutes, I've sworn. I said I wasn't going to do it on the good, the bad, the rugby. What a fucking idiot. Anyway, we're just cracking
living up to your moniker already. Right, okay. So we've had lots of people getting in touch. We've had lots of support. We've had lots of... well, I mean, Hask on the Bog was a real low point to start with. But we've also had some very curious messages of good luck as well, including from, as Tins mentioned a little bit earlier on, Netflix Tiger Queen herself, Carol Baskin. Have a listen to this.
Alex, Mike and James, I hear you've got a new show called The Good, The Bad and The Rugby. I don't know which one of you is which, but I'm going to bet that Pano is the rugby. Yeah. Good luck with the show, though. That sounds like it's going to be fun. And I think you should also remember that you should never microwave moule marinara. Stay cool, cats.
Many thanks to Carol. I hope she'll be dialing in for our first show and a loyal listener as we go from here. A highlight of 2020 for you, Hask. It's not really been a year of many highlights, but Carol saying bon chance and bon voyage has got to be up there.
I think we peaked with Carol Baskin. Unfortunately, if she hadn't gone and mentioned old Jimmy Savile a couple of weeks before, I think that kind of took the tarnish off. It turns out she will say anything, but no, I think having Carol Baskin promote
actually,
her at the
you
show.
And her, you and her are quite similar.
Very yeah. similar.
Someone's paying for something. They will pretty much say whatever you want them to say.
This is true. I mean, the amount of times that I'm on these, we've slagged me off before on it about the video apps where people book me to talk about weddings and funerals, whatever it might not so much funerals. Ah, he's dead. No,
more. Do you know, at my grandfather's funeral a couple of years ago, my uncle got a bit tongue-tied in the farewell speech and said, so, you know, what a great life, what a great guy. And can I ask you all, please, to raise a glass to my father's health? At which point everybody went, we can do. Ahoy! And everyone sort of filed in. I tell you what, it does break the ice. But, yeah.
I know. I love that.
Not too many on the funeral front, I think.
I've had to record so many of those videos that Chloe has been sitting, she's not here this evening, and I'll hear this, no, stop, fucking don't send it. I'll be like, what do you mean? She goes, you can't say that.
We're going down in a blaze of glory. Right, so rugby's back. Lo and behold, certainly in this part of the world, well done Super Rugby Aotearoa in New Zealand, which has been absolutely unbelievable if you have been tuning into that. Have you missed it? Tins Hask, I know you haven't, but have you missed it a little bit?
I have missed it, actually. I think there's quite a few talking points when you come back. Obviously, Manu going to Sail, a perfect situation for him, going from basically, well, should be the bottom club in the league to club in number two. So it's a great move for him. Obviously, there's been a few others. I saw that Creevy's just joined London Irish on a... He doesn't actually say a length of when he's in, but that's a great signing for Irish. I think a few things going at my own club in Gloucester. I think lockdown actually for them came at the right time. They've had a full clean out of their staff. And then there's some players that have come in and it's going to be like a restart for them, which hopefully will go well. The league is quite tight still how it's going to fully get through this competition and see it out to the end is going to be interesting. But more importantly, we just want to get fans back in there as well. I saw yesterday Tony Rowe said that if we don't get fans back in before Christmas, we've still got real financial problems. So there's lots of things to go. There's going to be lots of twists and turns and we'll be there along with it.
We certainly will. That tees it up nicely because we've got obviously a huge amount of content to bring you. We've got new ideas, new events, great guests, all part of a very exciting journey that we're starting on with the good, the bad and the rugby. Speaking of which, I think I'm right in saying we've got 23 shows left this year, and that falls very nicely into letting us pitch and pick a match day squad of guests and a coach as well that you would like to have as guests on this show. So 23 names. I don't know whether you've done any homework. Well, I don't know why we'd break the habit of a lifetime, but why don't we fire through? Who would we love to tee up between now and the end of the year?
So firstly, Tins. You didn't ask me what I think about rugby.
What do you think about rugby?
That's a bit fucking rude. Well, I said, actually, going to follow on with Tins, is a good friend of mine, an ex-teammate of mine, George Skivington, director of rugby, old teammate, Don Waldock. Very excited to see them. I think Gloucester's approach, Kingy back as bats coach. It's kind of quite mind-boggling. It's so refreshing. It's so bizarre that they've just chosen kind of young people, given them an opportunity. You know, I think George, aka the landlord, I mean, actually, I spoke to him the other day.
Gorgeous George.
He's reinvented himself. He said to me, we've come a long way from those days, Hask. It's Mr. Skivington now. I'm no longer the landlord. And also Don Waldock, I think brilliant. Young defence coach. Kingy with that experience. I think when Alex King was at Northampton, you know, he had a real clash with Dorian West. I think Dorian West was like, chief, don't pass the ball. Sounds a bit like Wellesley, but it isn't Wellesley.
it's sort of north of Watford gap. We'll give it to you.
Fine line between the two.
Very fine line. And he'd be like, no, chief, pills and tape. And, you know, Alex King wanted players to play with flair, wanted to do that. He obviously went away to Montpellier, you know, had that kind of, you know, had some success there. And I think he's amazing. I think he's someone with a lot of attention to detail. I think, you know, when he had an opportunity with Wales, people loved him. So I'm really excited about that. I thought the Crusaders winning it again in such fine form, fuck me, they know how to win. And it's pretty, pretty amazing. So and I enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to rugby coming back. I'm actually working for TalkSport because at the moment in lockdown, like most people, I've absolutely no cash, so I'm doing whatever I can. TalkSport, Northampton versus Wasps this Sunday.
Has no one in TalkSport ever listened to this, you know, other three of us talking rubbish before? Why in God's name would anyone come to you for an opinion on the sport?
And they passed the ball, and that was a tackle, and there was another tackle, and the ball's gone out. So I'll see you later.
You're sharing for a more insightful analysis.
Yeah, luckily you're doing it with a true pro, no doubt. What I did say about the Crusaders win is good to know they obviously celebrate themselves. Do you see the state of the cup?
Yeah,
it took a battering.
Accidentally dropped it, I think. Yeah. They're seeking spiritual guidance on how to rebuild it, which is, you know,
I've heard some excuses.
Tells you what you need to know. I think someone somewhere is properly cocked up.
It's definitely not a conversation for this show, spiritual guidance.
I've had a couple of nights out where I needed spiritual guidance and a doctor. So it was a priest and a doctor, not necessarily in that order. Yeah. I don't want to pronounce his right name. Who's that unbelievable player playing for the Hurricanes, the centre, who's just absolutely on fire at the moment?
Nani Laumapi?
Yes, that's the one. Oh my God, that bloke runs with hatred.
Did you see him burn Beauden Barrett?
I saw him burn Beauden Barrett and then bowl over Beauden Barrett. Like, you wouldn't, you know, yeah. Honestly, it was ridiculous. And afterwards, for a long time, rugby players obviously humble. You know, when I came through, mainly just probably directed at me, head down, arse up. You know, speak when you're spoken to. Don't do anything off the field. Be humble. Do this. Someone has obviously talked bad about him on the media because I don't know if you saw the Sky interview. Yeah. When he was like, people have been talking about, who's been talking? They know. And he was so angry that in his head, a bit like Michael Jordan, someone has slagged him and he was like, right, I'm going to fucking prove it and just mowed over everybody with just pure hatred. I love that. He's going to be a All Black starter.
Did you miss the memo about staying humble as a player? Or that just went into your boot bag?
It went into my topshagger@hotmail.com email. I didn't really check that. I didn't
control or delete. Names for our 23-week run between now and the end of the year.
Obviously, we have big goals to get Johnny on, the World Co. He would be in there as 10. There's a couple of 10s, Dan Carter. Billy V back.
I'd like Alan. I'm not going to call him Alan of Wales. I'd like to call him Alan. No, I'd like to call him not Alan from Wales. I'd like to call him Alan of Wales because I think that's far more Owen Glendower.
Of Wales.
I think Alan Wynne-Jones would be a really good guy to have on this. And I think there's a curiosity in him that means he quite wants to try it just because he doesn't give any to anyone. But Hask, you need to call him out, and I'd really like to chat to him.
Sergio Parise at 6.
Yeah, Parise would be great, actually.
Parise would be brilliant. Biggest hands on planet Earth. Hoggy. Yeah, we'll have a Hoggy, whose hair is looking fabulous these days. He's got a kind of... who were the guys in Vegas that had the tigers, you know?
Siegfried and Roy.
That's it, yeah. Hoggy's got a definite element of Siegfried and Roy at the moment.
Well, he's probably paid for that, though, hasn't he? Little weave.
Was working wonders. Leonard?
Yeah, obviously Lions and all that jazz. Would be great to get to, well, just get him to tell stories. That would be even better.
I want the bathtub story to be a thing.
I tell you who I'd like to get on as well, because he's an absolute hero, but I know he's got his own podcast, but would be David Flatman. I'd love to hear about Flats. Love to see what Flats has got to say. He's a comedy. He's one of the funniest people I've ever played with. When we were toured to Australia,
he
used to be called number one and I was called number two. And we were up at the front of the bus just keeping everyone entertained. It was a bit like Hale and Pace, but funnier.
Yeah, and you were obviously number two.
I was number two, yeah.
obviously. Yeah, I take that.
I'd like Guscott. I've got a real thing, and one of the things I almost the most satisfaction that I get from this doing this with you guys is when we have people on and every fan thinks they know them, and we are able to show a completely different side of them. And you know, the show we did with Will Carling was a classic example. Everyone thinks they know Will Carling, and actually, you spend an hour and a half chatting with him, and you just see a totally different side. I'd love to do Jeremy Guscott, and the one I would love more than anyone else to come on is Barnsley, Stuart, not Wayne. Hey. And you two will roll your eyes and you'll be like, no. But there is such a preconception about Stuart, and having worked with him for 15 years and loving him to bits, I would love just the chance to get people to say, actually, he's great, as opposed to the lazy sort of attacks that he gets. I don't think he bothers him in the slightest, but I love the shows when people just change their tune. Those are the most rewarding, I think, from my perspective.
I just need to say, Barry, just get this little caveat in here. Now, this isn't about plugging my book, because it's not even out yet. So my autobiography is coming out in October, right? I think on the 1st or 2nd of October. We might never get any guests again on when that comes out. So we need to condense this down, because I tell you what, there's about 4 or 5 people that we probably want to whiz in to start with, because I don't think they're going to pick up calls after that.
Do you want to name those people now or not?
No, not yet, because I don't want to give anything away. But I will say this, that someone invited me to do, hopefully we're going to be on the Lions tour, but someone said, do you want to do this lunch with Lions thing in the UK? And the bloke mentioned his name, and I was like, no, he's not going to want to talk to me again. So we'll probably leave that out.
Lanny would be quite good as a coach, but then he might.
Yeah, I've texted him and offered him. I don't think at the moment he would be that interested. But I've said there's an open offer, and I'd love to chat to him, and I'd love to chat to him about, you know, the positive things as well as the backstory.
I'd like to get Big Faz on. Owen Farrell, I'd like to get on. Any of the Farrells would be good. I
think Mrs. Farrell.
Yeah, that'd be interesting just to see what it's like living with, you know, with Owen, you know, Owen's lovely wife, Georgie.
Put a percentage on Owen coming on this show before Christmas.
If he's asking, I suppose. If it's Hask asking, then there's zero chance.
The reason I want to talk to him is he is, again, exactly what you just said, one of the most interesting, like intelligent, like so much more than kind of the tough professional that people see, and how he's developed into an incredible captain, that real balance he's got, you know, like what he's interested in. Like, he's an amazing dad. He's got the cutest kid in the history of the world, like, you know, Tommy. So I've talked to him about it, but I think, you know, games to be won and some jobs to be done, I think. So we'll see what that...
The love hasn't dwindled, has it? It may be unrequited, but it ain't dwindled.
No, I love him. He's such a lovely man. And then I'm trying to think. I tell you what I'd like to get on. Michael Checker or Jamie Joseph. I think that would be fantastic to hear about. I think it'd be really interesting to see. You know, Jamie Joseph as well, you know, what it's been like in Japan.
Sia Khaleesi?
Yeah. I'm working on that one.
We're making a hell of a rod for our own back here when we end up talking to... I won't name names, but...
Oh, we'll get Dodds on again. If we run out of ideas, we'll get Dodds on again.
Go to in case of emergency, break glass and just bring out Dodds.
Because honestly, he features heavily in the book.
Just get Balsh on. We've got two bankers there.
And any coaches? You mentioned, obviously, Czechs. Steve Hansen would be a goodie. I don't think he'd ever come anywhere near us, but he'd be a brilliant guy to have a chat to.
Die Young, because some of the bits I talk about Wasp, it'd be interesting to see what
Is he back in the game, or have I made that up?
He was going for Gloucester, I think.
Yeah, they talked about him with Gloucester, but yeah, I'd like to ask Dai Young, as being his assistant coach on the Barbarians, why he didn't speak to me the whole trip. That would be my...
Oh. Do you have an idea? No. Is that because you went to bed as he got up and he went to bed as you came?
Could be that we missed each other just about a few hours.
You were working shifts, were you? He did the day and you did the night kind of thing. Yeah. Punch in and punch out.
I was playing as well, so whether he just saw me too much of a player or anything else. The only thing he was is like, you just take the backs over there, and that was it.
There's one name, you've mentioned him already, but there's one name that we start with.
So Eddie Jones.
It's a hell of a way to start. I do know, genuinely, we've put so much effort into this. There's a huge amount kind of that we've worked on to get... I'm incredibly excited, but I'm also quite nervous about getting going again. It's on our shoulders now, and I think it's unbelievably exciting, but I think we just got to keep it simple and do what we do.
Now, there's so much to Eddie as well. For me, when he comes on, you know, I want to talk about all the different areas, but also for me, he's the closest to a Phil Jackson from Chicago Bulls and the Lakers, kind of 11 rings, kind of bloke, deals with characters, does everything. So I'm very excited to see what he's got to say.
Tins, you, actually both of you, you've got a lot going on in the next couple of days. So Tins, you're off, you're going to leave us now and go do the one show. And are you both doing...
Some of us have got to go promote the show. So yeah, and unfortunately, I have now got to go see, do an interview on the one show with Chris Ramsey, who's just knocked us off number one podcast.
To be fair, they are releasing pods. Yeah, at least they've done some pods.
They are doing shows, but I'm still, I think, what's it called? Shagged something and annoyed. So I'm
Shag Mary Annoy, I think.
Slightly annoyed with him for knocking us off.
Sounds like a day with my wife.
Good. Are you both doing Good Morning Britain tomorrow? You're doing Talk Sport. You're doing the Jeremy Vine show. I'm doing Tesco Radio in aisle four in the Isleworth branch on Tuesday. So if anyone wants to dial into that, I'll be promoting the good, the bad, and the rugby in the vegetable section.
Because things have been a bit quiet for you. I can see you doing some hospital radio. Do we want to sort that out? If any viewers are keen, maybe hospital radio.
North Norfolk Digital. Right, Tins, go well. Have fun. Let everyone know that we're up and running. And... we'll regroup soon. Yeah, we've got work to do in terms of building the contacts book. Go on.
Can I ask one question you've got to ask Eddie? Is if either Ben Teo had knocked out Brownie, would he have got in the squad? Or if Brownie had knocked out Ben Teo, would he have made the squad? That's all you got to ask.
So if one of them had finished it, would that have impressed as opposed to...
Was it a handbags fight and he's like, these two aren't, they're not in. If they'd have just come in, one of them, bang, done.
I'm surprised Teo, I mean, I love Brownie. I just mean, just in terms of Teo is a physical specimen, didn't just chin Brownie's head straight off. I can't understand how it didn't happen, because Teo's a big unit.
He's back in the NRL now, isn't he?
Yeah, he's back.
I think, you know, he's like, his image right company is called like Journeyman Enterprises, because he just literally tell that to any club. He's a guy I want to get on the show. 100% Ben Teo. What an interesting bloke, having played. Ah! The king!
Hey, boys.
On that note.
Good evening.
Teo, be good, mate.
Yeah, we're very well, thank you. We've been chewing the fat and trying to work out what on earth we're doing and which way we're pointing. But it's very nice to have you on to kind of bring a bit of order to proceedings. How are you? Are you hanging in there?
Very well, thanks. Yeah, it's all happening, mate, isn't it?
There's a lot going on.
Kick off on Friday. Is it Friday?
Where are you at this weekend? Which grounds are you going to? If you're allowed to any. Are you allowed to any? I don't know.
Yeah. Queens Friday, Exeter Sunday. No, Northampton Sunday.
Yeah. Ask, you can have a little catch up.
Eddie, I'm at the game working for Talk Sport. I'll be there, boss, with a little mask on.
That's your usual
rubbish.
You're
on radio as well, mate.
Mate, I'm everywhere, Eddie. I get where water can't, mate. I'm like coronavirus. Just as you think you got rid of me, I'll fucking turn straight back up again.
Right. Topical, certainly. Tins, have fun. Go well. Go and do your bit. We'll say goodbye to you.
Enjoy.
We'll swap one prince in for another. Eddie, it's lovely to have you on. And thank you so much for coming to have a chat with us. How's the last few months been? Have you got the tidiest lawn on planet Earth and you've done the gardening and the creosoting? Or I can see a very busy whiteboard behind you. Has it been pedalled to the metal as always?
Before lunch, Southern Hemisphere. After lunch, Northern Hemisphere. So some really good meetings, because the great thing about the period, apart from obviously all the stress that caused society, was that coaches around the world had a lot of time to share, and there was a number of really good information gatherings going on, so it was pretty profitable in this way. And then the last 5 weeks back in England and back in the office at Penny Hill, so we're starting to get a bit closer to rugby.
Is there a coach's WhatsApp group? I mean, do you genuinely chew the fat with Ian Foster, who's coming into the All Blacks, and, you know, Dave Rennie, etc.? Do you keep your cards quite close to your chest?
Not quite. But there's various groups. You know, there's a group of Australian coaches, group of New Zealand coaches. Yeah, there's a group in the UK that run a leaders group that had coaches from America, Belgium, all around the place. It was quite fascinating.
So what have you got done? Has it been, I use the expression, sort of sprinting to stand still, or have you actually managed to get some really good work done with the time that you've had?
Yeah, I think like everyone in this period, there's been a great chance for reflection, and certainly that's always a big part of coaching, but it's been exacerbated by the amount of time we've had. So as a coaching team, we've been able to reflect on the rugby that we've played and the rugby we want to play, and looking ahead, the rugby we want to play and what are the opportunities in terms of the rugby. We've been doing a fair bit of work on how we can coach better, because we had a new coaching team we'd only got together for 3 days before the Six Nations. You know, we had Matt coming from South Africa and Simon coming from the Sevens. And the last thing was a bit of a project I took on was to look at how we can select better. So been trying to talk to various sorts of bodies around the world that have done well in selection. You know, there's a lot of new data metrics going on, so I've been investigating that to see if we can get a bit sharper in selection. It might have got Hask a few more caps that were a bit sharper.
or possibly a few less, you never know.
Well, that could be the case.
Yeah, well, you know that. But I'm still trying to get that accelerations right. Basically, apart from telling me that he's seen milk turn quicker, I don't think I would have got many more contracts. You know.
What have you actually, sorry, I was going to say, what have you learnt about selection?
The big thing that stood out to me in rugby, we have all the metrics on what happens on the ball. And for most players, it's about 3% of their play. Yeah, you know, you look at, say, Mako Vinopolo carries the ball maybe 12 times a game, maybe at a max 3 seconds every carry. So that's 36 seconds. So the other 79 minutes and 64 seconds, he's either trying to get the ball, which we have a metric for tackles, he's cleaning out, or he's moving in the position to be effective support. And we don't have any actually effective measurements on movement off the ball. And I see rugby at the moment, the way it's evolving. If the referees keep refereeing the laws of the game, then we're going to get a nice mix in the game. We're going to get a bit of quick ball back. And the quicker the ball is, the more important work off the ball is. So we've been playing around looking at that. We don't have any particular answers at the moment, but we'll keep working on that.
Eddie, you always, you know, when we ever talked about stuff, you know, you always wanted to make sure that you married up the stats with, you know, other metrics, but also action on the field. You know, for example, in my case, you know, we're joking, but talking about accelerations and ability for players to move. You know, if you had 10 carries, if you looked at it on black and white, you go, oh, that's brilliant, 10 carries. But if absolutely I made no yardage by those tackles, or particularly didn't have any leg drive, all those kind of things, that would be seen as negative. Do you have to marry all those metrics up with the visual? Can you not be make sure you're not too, you know, stat based? Is that something you have to really worry about?
Yeah, well, that's one of the things we've been investigating for a few years now, is trying to match the GPS to the actual vision. So I've moved a little bit down that track, not as quickly as we'd like, because all that higher technology stuff costs a lot of money, and as you know, at the moment, rugby doesn't have a lot of money, but certainly it's an area we want to keep investigating.
There are so many things that I'd love to talk to you about, and hopefully we've got a bit of time to get into some of them. But knowing you as I do, sort of, you know, very, very, very loosely, the intensity with which you work is notorious. Please tell me you have had some time over the last few months to, you know, take up watercolours or learn the flute or rearrange your trainer collection and just have a bit of a break from it. I mean, have you had what can be termed a proper break from it?
Well, first 2 weeks after the Six Nations, my wife and I went to Okinawa, which is a tiny tropical island in Japan. This was just at the outbreak of corona. And basically, they were corona-free at that stage. So we embarked on a two-week CrossFit boot camp, our own CrossFit boot camp, which was great fun. Like, we train once or do two sessions in the morning and then one session at night, and then basically just ate and recovered. So that was a lot of fun. And then when we got back to Tokyo, we started playing tennis every day. So I've never seen so much in my life. I don't know how we're still married.
who wins? who wins at the tennis?
It's hit and giggle, mate. Very much hit and giggle.
I was going to ask Eddie if he was still with your wife after being trapped so long, because I can imagine you not being, because, you know, one thing we're going to talk about later on is I think how you're always on a path of self-development, how you always reach out to people. You know, you've talked about it, talk to different coaches to keep learning, but I can imagine you being caged up doesn't sit very well, that, you know, because of your work ethic. But I've also met your lovely wife, and she once told me she'd taken up boxing, and she demonstrated to me her left-right combo and almost took my head off. So I'm a little bit scared. Now you've sent her into CrossFit. If she's got massive guns now, you better watch your back, Eddie, because she will fill you in. I'm not going to lie to you.
Now, one of the smart things I did in Tokyo, we were staying in a hotel, and I hired another room and set up an office there. So I basically, you know, I kept the work day, which kept us sane. I think, I really don't know how some people did it locked in their house with families going on. I thought that must have been quite extraordinary times.
The health thing, though, is a really interesting thing because obviously you had a health scare a few years ago. How are you now? You look incredibly well. The tan is exactly on point. Do you ever worry about sort of health side of things, or are you in exactly where you want to be?
No, I was lucky, mate. When I had the stroke 7 years ago, it was a wake up call because we all thought we were supermen like Hask, and it reminded me that I wasn't. And since then, I've definitely paid more attention to sleep and tried to be more deliberate in getting recovery. And I think I managed to do that to an extent.
You're notorious for not sleeping. And we have actually, I think Hask in the past has just wondered whether you actually set the alarm, fire out the text and then go back to bed, or whether in the military they have this thing whereby they lie under their desk holding a pencil, having a snooze. And then when a subaltern comes in and says, right, time to do something, you add the pencil, I'm back in the game. Are you actually somebody who is up from 3:30 and working, or are you just quite good at playing the game?
No, in season, when we get into camp, it wouldn't be unusual to be up at 3:30 or 4 because you've always got something on your mind. And as you know, in England, when you lose a game, there's a fair bit of pressure around, so you want to get up and catch the early bird because that might help. But generally speaking, I'm up at about 5. I reread a book, actually, and it's one of the best books I've read over the last 10 years, a book called Deep Work. And it's just about working out your flow of your work day. So work out times of the day when you're most effective and times of your day when you're not effective. And it just reinforced, like, early in the morning's my most effective time for thinking and late at night's my most effective time. So the rest of the day is a bit of a muddle. And I've really sort of reinforced my work practice around that.
To be fair, Eddie, there's a couple of times I've knocked on the door and you pretended you were getting Annie out and there's a bigger little dog bed thing under the desk where you've popped out going, sorry, mate. I was like, Eddie, were you? But I was always too scared to say anything. That's why. So if you're good in the morning, you're good at night. You've been sleeping under that bed in the day.
Sometimes, mate, you got to have a nap. Sometimes.
Of course you do.
It was interesting. You know, John O'Neill was the CEO of Australian Rugby, and I remember catching him on a plane, and he was working for the guy that was in charge of, and he might still own, guy called Frank Lowy, I think his name is, or Lowe, and he's in charge of Westfield Shopping Centres, owns Westfield Shopping Centres. At that stage, he was the CEO of Soccer Australia, and he was saying he had to work 24 hours a day to keep up with the owner because the owner had just worked like 4 hour stint, have an hour off, have a sleep, then work another 4 hours, and he had to be ready to go when the owner was on the call. And I think people who've got a good work ethic are able to work out their work day and find the time to have a sleep because you've got to sleep.
Is that how you unwind, Eddie, reading? It's because I've always wanted to know that because obviously Alex, you joke about the emails, but people always talk about it. I've always known, you know, routine is key. The routine's been the key to getting through COVID. I think understanding exactly whether you're a morning person, night person, you know, sleeping in. I read a really interesting book on sleep cycles recently, talking about sleeping in, you know, 90-minute increments. But, you know, is that, how do you unwind? Is it that, is it reading your key?
I think being curious, mate. I've always been curious, always wanted to know how you could do things better. You know, I met a bloke today. He finished a gym session and he runs 3 body repair shops. And he said, I asked him, I said, you know, how have you been successful? Because he obviously got plenty of money. He said, oh, I just work hard, mate. I work harder than everyone else. So I've always had that curiosity. And I think, yeah, you're either born with curiosity. And I think when you've come from probably a tougher background, you tend to be more curious. Whereas if you've had everything, maybe you don't have to be so curious because you've already got it. And when you're curious, you want to find out how you get it. And so I've been lucky like that. You know, I've been blessed like that.
It's a really interesting point. And it actually leads exactly onto the question I really wanted to ask you, which is there are coaches in the world who you know, and then there are coaches who have a bit of a mystique. And you are one of those who are, you're incredibly sort of enigmatic in what you do. And I just wonder whether you are aware of that and you quite like cultivating it, or whether it just is who you are because of the journey you've been on.
It's probably, again, one of the things I learnt. You make a lot of mistakes when you're a young coach because you think you know everything and you want to be seen, you want to have a persona because that's your way of finding a way in the world. You know, I had a few periods where things didn't go well and it taught me the only person you can be is yourself. So all I try to be is myself. I love rugby. I love coaching. I feel so humbled to have the opportunity to coach at the highest level. You know, there's plenty of other people that are smarter than me that could coach at this level. So I've been lucky like that. So I don't try to create any sort of persona at all, apart from the fact of trying to be myself.
You're very good at it. What is it? You touched on your upbringing. What is it about your upbringing, do you think, that has helped you, forged you, turned you into the coach that you are today?
First thing, mate, I was lucky I played with the best players. That's the greatest gift you get. And Haskell, no. The best players are the best coaches. And I played with the three Ellis, you know, who were just like, they were out of another world, mate. You couldn't believe the things they could do with the ball. You know, the three of them were so different. Mark was driven. Glenn, you know, was the laziest bloke you ever meet. I've got to tell this story when Glenn came on the Australian tour with us and he'd put on a bit of weight. You know, he'd gone from about 90 to 120 Ks. And I remember Hask at lunchtime sitting down with him and giving him a fitness program. And I was just thinking, I was sitting there, I didn't say anything. I thought, Hask, you're just wasting your time, mate. Can you remember that, Hask?
Yeah, I do. And the best bit was, is Eddie was, he'd make me go up when Glenn would go up to the buffet and get extra food. Eddie'd be like, Hask, get that off his backing plate. So I'd have to go over to Glenn, take the potatoes off. And Glenn was looking at me going, he'd never met me. And obviously, it's a different generation for me. So I had to learn about who the Ellers were. You know, I had to go. I found out, obviously, a part of the, you know, three of the greatest Australian players ever. And Eddie's got me telling him how to do burpees, writing him a fitness plan. And at the end of it, he goes, how's Glenn, mate? Is Glenn done any of it? I went, I don't think so, Eddie. It's fucking useless, man. But I do know what the best thing is. Because it was a great icebreaker, that's what, I mean, we'll come on to talk about it later, but for someone like myself, getting to work with Glenn, it was actually quite nice getting to know him because Eddie's very good at breaking the ice, you know, very inclusive. I think that's one of your, like, because I want to ask you later on about kind of your approaches with different teams, but there's nobody in your environment that can sit on this periphery and not involve themselves. And I think, you know, that's what's quite really unique, you know, because some teams carry people, but I think the way, and I might be wrong, because everybody has to have a role, has to be pulling in the same direction with Eddie's plan, that development. Nobody can be a passenger. And I think it's really good to have all these mixes of different people. And it was such a nice way of breaking it. But I did spend, I sent him a copy of my book, Perfect Fit. But I think he's been using it as a doorstop. He got some barbecue sauce on the corner and he ate the whole thing.
Right, he sent me a photo. He's lost a bit of weight. He started walking during the corona. He's lost about maybe 20 Ks. He looks really good. Like, he's just one of the best guys in the world. And so, you know, getting back to your question, I was blessed by playing with those guys and I could understand how good players could do it. And they weren't great at explaining what they were doing, but they knew how to do it. And I think that's one of the tricks of coaching. Some players need to be told and other players don't need to be told. And getting that balance right is one of the most difficult things.
Interesting. I've got a really good quote here about you as a player, and you're talking about your playing days. A shortage of bulk was made up for with aggression, plenty of lip, a good skill set, and a refusal to let anyone intimidate him. If there was a set to, he was always pretty close to the heart of it. You'd always hear him, that guttural, rasping, grinding, fingernails across the chalkboard voice, winding up opponents. Fair?
I don't know who thought of saying all of that. It doesn't sound like an Australian, does it?
I'll hold the source, but I think it was, teammate.
Well, I had to find a way to be good, mate. I wanted to play at the highest level. I wanted to play for Australia. I was desperate to play for Australia. The only thing I wanted to do, I was 80K hooker. I had to find a way to be productive. You know, when you haven't got great genes, you know, you're 5'8" and you've got to eat everything you can to get to 80Ks, you've got to find some other ways of being in the game.
We talked about it a little bit before, I think you and me, about being kind of mixed race growing up in Australia in those early days when it wasn't always known to be the kind of most accommodating place.
Yeah, no, again, I was probably lucky. I can still remember my primary school classes. There was myself, there was an Egyptian boy called Richard Bahaja, and then there was the Aboriginals, boys, the Ellers, a couple of others, and then they're all white Anglo-Saxon. And, yeah, because you want to be liked, don't you? Yeah, when you're young, you want to be part of the group. You want to be included. You know, we're social beings, humans. And I knew the only way I could do it was getting the cricket team and getting and at that stage, the rugby league team. So I worked really hard to try to get in there. And once I got in there, then it sort of elevated me to another level. And I remember feeling so sorry for Richard Bahaja. He got all the rubbish and it was tough for him. He was quite a bright boy and he became a lot more reclusive because he got a tougher time than I did. And so you got carried along in the sports team because of that. And the other great thing, my mother was a great role model because she didn't carry grudges. Like, people would be racist to her, but she wouldn't carry a grudge. And I think today, you know, when people say things to you, I still feel sorry for them. Yeah, I remember we had that run-in in South Africa and some bloke was yelling out this most stupid stuff and we raced up and we were going to have him on. He raced up there and it was a bit of fun, you know, but I just felt sorry for him. It's his problem, not my problem.
It's a heck of a question. I don't sort of drop it on you, but what do you make of the world today? I mean, do you look and see progress? Do you look and see utter despair, particularly in a sporting environment? And you look at Colin Kaepernick and it's more topical, certainly, I think, than it's ever been in my lifetime before. But how do you see it as someone who's lived through it and the reemergence of the issues that we're discussing today?
We're always making progress. I think we're making progress in the right way. And at times there are events that shows the progress has stabilised and we need to keep driving it forward. And I think that's always the case, that this latest round where it's sort of everything's all come together at a certain time has shown that we're probably stabilised for a period of time. We need another kick along, another reminder. Let's make sure we are being fair and equal to everyone.
You know, just I was just interested about saying that, you know, being at school and stuff, and obviously people wanting to be accepted, and the fact that your training, your approach has kind of changed. Do you think that for a long period of time, when you were, you know, because everyone jokes about old, you know, you and I have jokes about old Eddie and kind of finding your identity, and then being so accepting of how you were, that's changed and kind of mellowed you out? Because I think the way you deal with the media and do other things, you're, this is the way I am, take it or leave it. You're confident because you've had some success and now you feel that you can be whoever you want to be. Does that make sense?
No, and again, mate, I think you keep learning, you know. Every mistake you make, you've got to learn from, and you've got to accept responsibility for your mistakes. And I think, again, when I was young, I wouldn't accept responsibility for mistakes. You'd be blaming people. Yeah, someone asked me a great question the other day, you know, what happens in a game in the second half when your team's not playing how they should be? You know, and you're dropping the ball, how do you react? Well, when you're a young coach, you know, you're saying, I told him to do that. I don't know why he's not doing that. I told him to do that. But now I sit there and I think, well, I just haven't coached well enough. You know, I haven't got the message through. I haven't coached that well enough. And that's more about accepting the responsibility you've got, because, as you know, mate, as a player, you want to win. I've never coached a player that doesn't want to win. So everyone wants to do their best. And if they're not doing their best as the team wants them to do their best, then the way they've been coached hasn't been right. You haven't been able to make their eyes shine. You haven't been able to get the right information through. And you've got to accept that. And that's a hard thing to accept, isn't it?
Yeah, very much
so.
Do
you, with the journey you've been on as a coach, do you look back now on previous roles you've had and previous relationships you've had with players and wince a little?
No, not at all.
No regrets?
Probably at some times wish I would have done it in a different way, but I know that every player I've coached, I've cared for, I've wanted them to get better, and sometimes the approach was tough, and definitely you couldn't do it today, but you could do it back then, and my intent was always of the best, so I don't have any regrets about it, no.
So Ben Darwin, who wrote recently, Eddie isn't my favourite person in the world. 4 years as a player being harangued, taunted and dragged, kicking and screaming into a professional career means that his name doesn't fill me with an enormous amount of joy. But I would not have played for Australia if it were not for him. Is an interesting one.
Yeah. It's a very interesting one. And I could tell a lot of stories about that, but I don't think it helps. Ben's got his point of view and he's allowed to stick to that. So it's a good story for you.
One thing I always wanted to know with you is, do you have a set approach, or, you know, or do you choose a different methodology for different teams? So, for example, if you're going to the England team, did you think this is the certain way I want to approach these guys, or do you evolve as you're going? Because I'd be interested to see whether difference in Australia, different with the Japan team, to different how you were with England team.
It's a bit like, mate, you carry a thermometer around. you put the thermometer in and you work out what the team needs at that time. Like, yeah, with the England team, there were some obvious circumstances. 2015 World Cup had ended in disappointment. There were fractures within the team. So we had to find some way quickly. There was an obvious thing we had to do was get people together, get a certain purpose about what we were going to do. Whereas other teams, it's more difficult. You can't find out what the actual problem is and it takes your time. Like, I coached the Queensland Reds, who'd been third last for 3 years in a row, and I couldn't for the life of me work out the problems of the team. And I actually made the team worse because of that. And even though I look back now, I still don't know whether I could have done any better. And so you always, whereas with Japan, again, Japan was a pretty easy win. They needed to feel good about themselves. You know, so we came up with this extraordinary dream for them to be top 10 in the world. You know, their average score at the World Cup was 85-0 defeat. And then we were gifted by the time we had and gifted by the players we had, and we were able to create something that was special for them.
It's really interesting you talk about your time at the Reds. And I've heard you speak and interviewed so many times, and there are so many successes in your career. But one thing that I never, ever hear a coach talk about is what it's like. I don't know whether that's because when it comes to an end, your silence is bought, or it's part of the dismissal, as it were. But what it's like as a coach when it comes to an end. Can you give us a snapshot of, I suppose, the emotions, the sort of almost the mechanical process of what happened with you at the Reds, Saracens, etc. And I understand if you don't want to go into it, but we hear so much about the success. I'd love to know what it's like for you personally when it doesn't go right.
Yeah, I can speak about the Reds particularly. I was distracted, mate. I took the job because I wanted to prove people wrong, because I'd been sacked as the Australian coach and they'd been third last for 3 years. I'd already decided I was going to go to Saracens, you know, so I was just going there for a short period of time. And as I said, I couldn't get a real feel of the team. I had a couple of players that I went there because I wanted to coach, like Elton Flatley, and I think he only played one game, if he mightn't have even played a game for us. So it was all these difficult situations. And quite frankly, I wasn't a good enough coach to be able to cope with it. And then I had a really good relationship with the chairman. And I remember coming back to Brisbane after the end of the last game, and we had breakfast at, I think it's called Breakfast Creek, breakfast at Breakfast Creek. And had a nice mashed avocados on toast, nice flat white. Yeah, it was a really nice breakfast. He said, I think, mate, it's probably best we call it quits. And that was it. And I was literally on my way. But I still think about it a lot because I'm disappointed I wasn't able to do better for that team. And the only thing I get a little bit of pleasure was that I played guys like Genia and Cooper, who then went on to win a Super 12 or Super 14 4 years later. And so sometimes you do some of the work to make a team win and you don't deserve credit for you, but from the coaching point of view, they're the positive bits, because in any negative situations, there's positive bits, just as in positive situations, there's negative bits.
It's fascinating. And do you as a coach, over your mashed avocado, do you know at that point and you're sort of at peace with it, or does your world fall apart as a coach? Because you are so the fulcrum of everything that team is about that... I mean, the pressure going through you, even when you're successful, is extraordinary. I just, you know, did you do self-doubt and despair and that kind of thing? Or actually, do you feel it as the right decision at the time?
No, I felt it was the right decision at the time. And as I said, I was on my way to Saracens anyway.
Yeah.
And I was really, it's funny how things turn around, because I did that. I did 6 months at Saracens of the previous season. You know, they'd won four or 16 games. I came in, we won six. I think we won four or six games to stay up. And I'd already signed to go back there 2 years later because I wanted to do that. I felt like it was a great project, Saracens. And that was a great story in itself. You know, the CEO there was Mark Cinderbury, who was my CEO at the Brumbies, who I had a great relationship with. And after 6 weeks, again, circumstances changed, you know. He was sacked as the CEO. They brought in a South African CEO. Half the club was sold to South Africans. And I basically then decided I wasn't going to stay. And that then embarked me to go back to Japan, which then evolved to be a really good period for me. So, you know, everything has a twist and turn. And you just got to ride it. And you've got to keep acknowledging the fact that you can always get better as a coach. And when you've made a mistake, accept the mistake, because no one's perfect and no one knows what to do all the time, because coaching's bloody difficult, because you're dealing with 30 blokes who have all got different ideas of what's good in their head. And today, even more so, I think it's even more difficult.
It's such a roller coaster, and it's so all consuming, not only for you, but your family as well. Do you ever find yourself just thinking, God, I'd love to have gone into insurance or been a mortgage broker or sat in an accountancy and just pushed pens and paper around?
I remember maybe it was the second year I was at the Brumbies. We hadn't had a good first year. I remember driving to the game one day at Bruce Stadium. I remember I was sick in the stomach thinking, if we get beaten today, this is going to be hard. I remember thinking, it might be nice just to put on a suit on every day, get on the same bus at 8 o'clock, have a nice little packed lunch, do your work, have lunch, cup of tea in the afternoon, game home at 5, put on Neighbours, and that's the end of the day. And it probably stayed with me for a minute. And then I thought, but how lucky am I to do this job? And that's the thought that stays with you. And I think, this corona period, I think it's made it even more evident. Teams now that are playing, and we'll see it in the Premiership, the teams that really love playing with each other are going to do really well, because they don't need the crowd, they don't need the adoration, they'll just get on with them and they'll play it because they love the game, they love their club, they love the players they're playing with, and the coaches love the game. So, we're the lucky ones.
How good is Mrs. Jones for life on your roller coaster? Is she sort of fairly disinterested and just lets you get on with it, or does she ride it all with you?
No, she never gets involved in it at all. She's probably the most she's ever been physically involved in a team has been in England. She's just a good person. She's got to be better than a good person who married for me for 28 years.
I wouldn't dare agree. I remember doing something with you a while ago, and I can't remember where it was or what it was, but you also referenced your daughter, who you said had been hugely sort of influential in developing you as a coach in your relationship with her. And I think it's what you were touching on, is that it's made you much more empathetic. Is that something that you sort of recognise today? Is that something she recognises in her relationship with you?
I don't know whether she recognises it. I look back and I don't think I was a very good father, particularly in her teenage years when she needed me the most, because I wanted her to be like me. I wanted her just to get on with it, accept whatever happened. But kids that age, they're different. They think differently. Every generation is different, isn't it? Like, I look at my parents, they went through, my father went to at least 3 or 4 wars. He left school at 15 to work in a gold mine. Yeah, and my abiding memory of him, when he had holidays, he'd still work. He'd still get a second job to work. Yeah, and that was the life they had. And he never complained. Yeah, in my life, I've never had anything, a great imposition, until this pandemic. So you look at the small imposition I've had in my generation compared to my father's, and then you look at the generation after us. They've all had everything they've wanted. They get the sneakers they want. They're not wanting for anything, because that's how we bring them up, and it's our fault. And they think differently because of that. And I wasn't good at understanding that, because I wanted Chelsea to be like me. And so it made me understand the players more, that I can't want them to think like I think. They are going to be different, and I think that's helped my understanding of the players.
Yeah, it's amazing you say that, Eddie, because I've worked with some coaches in England jobs, and I know you're hard on yourself. You're not after games you've talked, I've seen you in press conferences say that I didn't coach the team well enough. And I think, I think sometimes everybody in a squad and a team has to be self-reflective, and everyone can always do more. People can always do more. But I think sometimes you're being harsh on yourself, but you never let it filter into the team, which is interesting, because I've had other coaches and it was almost a mirror image. We lost the game against Ireland for that Grand Slam game. It happened twice on the two separate occasions. And the first time, none of the coaches came into the change room. Nobody spoke to anyone, because everyone was upset and they made it personal. They couldn't hide it. But when we lost in that Grand Slam, the last Six Nations, the second last time I was to play for you, you came in and spoke to everybody and were honest, and however much you must be hurting. And I imagine you did exactly the same thing on the World Cup, how you disguised it. Is that the kind of lessons you've learned from Chelsea, to be able to do that, to be able to put your own agenda to one side and remember that it's not all about tough love, and some people are sensitive and need to have a different approach?
Definitely, mate. Definitely. And I think you can only get better in that. And you see that, I reckon, you see that in the football coaches now. You see the really good football coaches like Klopp and Mourinho, Pep, when they're coaching the game, they're bloody tough on the players, aren't they? They're yelling and screaming. But as soon as the game finishes, regardless of the result, they're supportive of the players and they never at all ever criticise their players. And you can see that the players enjoy that support. Because the other thing, particularly in England, mate, and you'll know it better than anyone, if you lose a game in England, you know the media is going to come after you. And that's their job. I'm not criticising them for doing it, but that's the situation. So the players need support. You know, they don't need the coaches to be at them. They need the support of the coaches to get them through that period because it is going to be tough. You know, someone will be singled out. He's played his last test and it's a difficult time for him.
Do you find that's why you sometimes, you know, deflect? You know, I've joked with you and we've joked many times on House of Rugby, and I know Chelsea watches some of the House of Rugby stuff because I know you ain't watching it, and I get a little text message every now and then and I say, you know, and I'll get this hat and I'll be like, Eddie, how the fuck do you know that? And you'll be like, my daughter, mate. I'll be like, okay, good. Because, you know, either you're lying or Eddie's our number one fan. It's either one of the two, I don't know. But, you know, I wondered about the media stuff because do you mind being the kind of the scapegoat almost sometimes and taking the heat? Do you deal with that personally or do you see it as your role as coach? You don't have a problem with it?
I see it as a role, particularly in England, mate, because the media is so vicious and can turn so quickly. What sells papers here? Either you're a brilliant team and you're winning everything, you're losing and you're terrible, or the coach is going to get the sack. But they're the three main headlines, aren't they? So you want to be that top one. I'm happy to accept the middle one if that's going to help take the pressure off the team. And the last one, you don't want to add to those waves. So I've particularly seen that as a responsibility here.
Because after that game against France, you know, I was particularly outspoken because I've talked about the media and I understand it's a business. But I remember one particular article after that loss to France at the beginning of Six Nations, and someone wrote a headline, "The long-suffering England fans are sick of it." I was like, what do you mean they're fucking sick of it? You lost a World Cup final and won game and won everything else. So you must kind of sometimes feel vindicated in the approach you take.
Yeah, I just get on with it, mate. But I enjoyed our win against Ireland particularly because, yeah, everyone said I was grumpy that week, but I wasn't grumpy. I wanted them to talk about Ireland. And the whole week they spoke about Ireland because we didn't say anything. So they're relying on me to give them headlines. And when I don't give them headlines, they've got to create other stories. So it was perfect.
What line that you've thrown out there have you chuckled most at in your office afterwards? Was it Noel at flanker or Curry at scrum half, or has there been any way to sort eating out of my hand at this point in time?
Nah, mate, because it can always bite you. But like Jack Noel, I'm serious, mate. He could play a number of positions, and that will happen. Yeah, those hybrid players will come into the game. You can see it happening. You'll have flankers who can play wing and winger who can play flankers. Because you look at how outside the tight five, how homogeneous the body types become, and the skill will change to allow players to play a number of positions.
Yeah.
And I think it's, you know, we probably won't get there in my time, but it'll definitely happen.
We shall see. We must take a break and fill up glasses together. Just before we do, I just want to quickly confirm 7 consecutive wins over the Wallabies. Am I right in saying that Chelsea used to have the desk next to Michael Checker when he was at the ARU and head coach? And I just wondered whether there was any sort of double photocopying going on or glasses against the office door. I know there weren't, but any inside info?
No, as soon as I think it became 1-0, she got moved to another section.
Poor Chelsea. The ills of her father suffering her career progression. Eddie, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us. We've got lots more to talk about if you're good for time. But in the meantime, we'll obviously pick up on England, what Eddie does to relax. We'd love to get your views on Hask, who's very excited to have you on the show this week. You are listening to episode 1 of The Good, The Bad and The Rugby on 21.6 Sport with me, Alex Payne, alongside James Haskell, and the aforementioned England head coach. You can also get involved on our socials as well, Good, Bad and The Rugby Facebook group. We apparently have had thousands of you joining in the past week alone. I think we're through 11,000 on Instagram as well. Just type in Good, Bad, Rugby and do get involved. Please be nice to each other in there. Same on Instagram, same on Twitter as well, at Good, Bad, Rugby. Come and play. We'll hopefully have, yeah, a bit of fun. Back to England, Eddie. I suppose just actually going back, had you spoken to England in years gone by? Did you ever have a conversation with England post Clive Woodward in about 2004?
I think it might have been 2006, 2007. They were looking for a director of rugby. Someone, a headhunter came down to Sydney and I remember chatting to them. they came back and they said, you're in the last two, we want you to fly to England to interview. And at that stage, I'd already had met Nigel Ray, so I gave Nigel a ring just to get some background to see whether they were serious or they just wanted someone in the mix to make it look like it was genuine. Anyway, yeah. It was more of the secondary one, so I knocked it on the head, didn't go ahead with it.
Interesting. Have you always had a curiosity with England, or was it just the time was right post 2015?
Well, the curiosity was only the fact that I knew Steve Borthwick very well, and Steve came and coached with me at Japan, and because of that, in the 2015 World Cup particularly, I watched their games quite closely because we had a bit of a bet. We had a Welsh defence coach, Lee Jones, Steve, and Australia in the same pool. So Steve doesn't drink, but Lee does. So we had a couple of bottles of red wine on the results, and you know, it was good banter. But I watched the games really closely, and that's where the fascination came, because I remember they had a lot of good players, but it just didn't seem to gel. There was something wrong, and it was just thinking at that time, it's only going to take a little bit to get these guys right, because they had a number of good players, and that was when any sort of fascination happened.
What is extraordinary, I was looking back through your CV or resume, the England role is the longest role you've had in coaching. Did you know that?
No, but... Yeah, there's some extenuating circumstances too.
Like, yeah,
I'd
sure.
I'd maybe still be at the Brumbies, mate, 30 years. And you move to the Brumbies and you go to the Wallabies. And most international jobs are four-year jobs.
Yeah.
And again, I could have stayed at Japan but decided to move on by my own volition. So, yeah.
So why England? Why England, therefore, for the second term?
Oh, because I haven't fulfilled the job yet. I still think there's more in the team, and I think I can get a bit more out of them. I really like the growth opportunity in this team. You know, you look at it, the last World Cup, we were the youngest team ever to make the World Cup final, and that has its challenges in itself, because most World Cup finalists don't make it past the quarterfinal of the next World Cup, and I think that's because they're not hungry enough. You know, they think they've done all right, and you get players who have been close to their peak then go to the next World Cup because they want to go to the next World Cup, not so much they want to win the World Cup, because it takes an enormous amount of effort to win a World Cup. The amount of physical effort you've got to put in, the amount of mental discipline you've got to put in. And so to get the right balance for this team is going to be one of the most intriguing parts of it. How many we keep from the previous World Cup, how we bring new players in, how we get that balance right before the next World Cup. And particularly in England, it's even more challenging because the first 2 years of any World Cup campaign, it's difficult because you've got the Lions coming at the second year, so you don't have your players at their best for a period of time. So you've got that last 12 months and more, particularly that last 3 months, to really get the team right.
Were you shocked about how much the job was about other things than just coaching with England in particular, or is that like that with every international team?
Well, definitely there's more potential distractions here. But one of the things I really set out here to do was just coach the team. I haven't tried to get involved in the politics of what clubs want, what the national team wants. I've tried to keep my nose out of it as much as I can. I made that one comment about the bath owner, got into terrible trouble from that.
What happened? Did you sit on the naughty step at the RFU for that? What is terrible trouble? Were you?
I think I was going to go in front of the discipline committee at one stage. And then I had a meeting with the discipline committee member and that didn't go too well. So I think I was in trouble there for a while. And the team wasn't playing well, so it was all... But well, I've deliberately tried to steer clear of those things, Hask, and I think that's helped. And left all the development side, all the political side to other people to look after.
Because that's been a pitfall, I think, for other people, knowing, you know, worrying so much about what's happening at the top, what's happening with the grassroots, what's happening with the age group teams, what kit people are wearing, everything else. Like, because it almost becomes, a lot of people have said, it becomes so much more about everything else other than the coaching, but you clearly love the coaching. So it's interesting you managed to keep on to that, because, you know, it's impressive to do that.
And we had Gary Lester look after kit, so I didn't have to worry about it, mate. What a great man, eh?
Gary the kit man was unbelievable. I'll never forget the first day. The first day I turned up to England camp, we had a guy called Gary Lester as a kit man who was like, he's a bit like the character from the Phoenix Knights, where he reckons, he goes, oh, Haskell, it's unbelievable. I've just been playing tennis with Roger Federer. Like, fuck off, Gary. Yeah, but I just saw, saw Tom Cruise in reception. He knows me. He's like, no, he doesn't, you fantasist. But we had one, the van pulled up outside the Penny Hill Park, the training ground, and I was with Dylan. And we were walking back, and he went, "Oi, Gary, can I get some cycling shorts?" So Gary opened the van, and he had a load of kit. And Dills was like this, like, one for me, two for you. And Gary went, "Whoa, whoa, you know, you can't have all that kit, because kit man never let you have kit." Dylan and I just turned around and looked at each other and went, "Fuck off, Gary. We're not going to stuff you in the back of the van. It's not your kit." And so he looked really rattled. So, you know, it was always a head-to-head. But, but Gary's no longer there, is he? He got phased out. Like every good
I was just looking at sort of and reflecting on your 4 years, and you'll probably do the same. It's been hugely successful. It's been incredibly entertaining. And one of the things that you have done over the course of 4 years is unlock some very big characters in your squad. And I'm interested to know whether you actively do that. You look at a Marla and an Ellis Genge and a Billy. You know, they're recognisable now with outside of the sport, which perhaps, you know, in the 4 years previous or in past gone times wasn't the case. Do you like creating characters? And we've obviously got one between us on this call. Why is that important to you?
Yeah, it goes back to diversity. You need diversity of characters. You need diversity of personality to make a team. You know, there's a team environment. If you've got homogeneous people, you've got homogeneous characters, you've got everyone who wants to work hard from 9 till 5, it can be a boring place. So you need that mix. You need guys like Hask who are good at taking a joke and also good at taking a joke themselves. You know, they're really important guys. Guys like Marla, a bit different. Billy can be anything from the most model player to this uncontrollable guy. But that makes a team. And, you know, your ability for the senior players particularly to manage those characters is important. And, you know, I'm sure everyone's watched that, The Last Dance. If Rodman was in that team and he didn't have Jordan and he didn't have Pippen, he wouldn't have been successful and the team wouldn't have been successful. So you've got to have mechanisms to control those characters as well, because if you let those characters run wild, they tend to dominate the team. So it's always getting that balance right. Yeah, Hask was one of the great, great successes of our first couple of years, and he was instrumental, him and Dylan, because they were a bit old-fashioned in terms of they still remembered the old times and they wanted the team to mix, and they were good characters for us, really good characters for us.
I want to ask you about Haskin. Who's your Pippin? Who's your Rodman? Who's your Jordan?
That's hard. Well, the Jordan-type character is definitely Owen. Like, Owen's at it, wants to win all the time. The other guy, I remember, George Gregan, was the same, exactly like that. You need someone like that. Their learning is how they can still be like that and retain relationships within the team, because it is. When you're at it the whole time, yeah, you tend to burn people, and Owen's learning that really well. Pippen is your understated bloke. So we had Rob Shaw for the first couple of years, just worked hard, great character, always giving. We've got a few of those. Morrow's like that now. He's a hard-working player. Rodman, I think Marla's a bit like that, isn't he? Though he doesn't go to Las Vegas, he finds somewhere else to go. I'm not sure where he goes.
He goes down to Brighton in that weird pub he drinks in. That's about it.
I was going to say that. There's a meme in there somewhere along the way. Yeah. So the question about Hask is the three stages of Hask. Your thoughts on Hask, having never met him, first impressions, and knowing him now as you do.
Yeah, I was lucky I met Hask. I think the pub was called Vic Traders, wasn't it, in Tokyo? Got drawn there for something. And I met him, and it was really good to chat to him, because what I was really impressed with Hask, you know, he'd been a public school England cap player, and he went off on an adventure. And you got to have a lot of courage to do that. He went to Japan and played. I think he might have been the first, like, celebrated England international player to play in Japan. I'm sure it was, you know, he enjoyed it, but it was difficult because the rugby there is, it's a different sort of rugby. And then he took himself to Dunedin, which is the staunchest, most provincial area of New Zealand rugby. And he did really well there. So I thought, this guy's got a lot to give. And when I got the job, I thought, I've got to try to get the best out of him because he's a physical beast. And have a look at him even today, you know, and he's in his, I'm in a jungle office there. He looks like a beast, doesn't he?
Please don't ask him to take his clothes off. He'll only willingly oblige.
So I thought we could get something out of him for the team, and he was terrific. Like, honestly, him and Rob Shaw and Hartley and Danny Kerr and Mike Brown and those blokes were absolutely instrumental in getting England back on their feet. You know, and they don't get a lot of credit, but those guys who've been part of the unsuccessful 2015 World Cup and been part of that team, they were really great for us. And, you know, that's one of the difficult things when the team then moves past that is to ease those guys out of the team. And it's never easy. It's never pleasant. And it never gets any easier.
Hask, when you heard Eddie Jones was the new head coach of England, your thoughts were?
I was excited. I think I was excited because I'm always some of these people that always talks and wants to know about people. And I'd actually met Eddie even before Vic Traders. Great memory, Eddie. It was actually when we went to I actually met you when you were at Saracens coach. Do you remember we met in Berkeley Square in that bar?
With your dad, mate.
With my dad, which is normally when people meet me and my dad.
JamesHaskell.com.
Yeah. Right, when most people,
the brand.
But you joke. When most people meet me and then meet my dad, we never speak to them again. But Eddie was obviously in charge of Saracens, and I was like, you know, I knew all about Eddie Jones. Like, you know, my contract was up with Woss, and we went and talked and had a really interesting conversation. You know, Eddie could be quite intimidating, but he was really friendly, and we had this conversation. He was interested in me signing for Saracens, and I went to him and we talked about it. And just as I was back, we were in conversation. Eddie then left Saracens, as he said, when the CEO came over. So I then didn't have an opportunity to really kind of get to know him and work with him. And then I met him at the Trader Vic's, and it was in Japan, and we got on to have lunch. And I was my usual self, which people can either switch off, but Eddie and I have always got on really well, and we had that, we talked a lot. And then, you know, when I came in, I'd obviously heard that, you know, Eddie could be, you know, quite tough. And I said it in my book, I said that I'd heard that Eddie was like a bit like a nuclear bomb, like he was going to go off at any time. But you know what, in the entire time I've known him, I've never seen him angry. I've never seen him. He's never said a bad word to me. He's always been honest, which is what he's wanted as a player. And one of the most exceptional things and why I think he's the best coach I've ever worked with is because of exactly what we talked about at the top of the show, is the relationships. He knew exactly how to get the best out of me. He knew straight on, talk about his thermometer, that all he had to do was to tell me to go and work, but also just provide the answers and provide people, and I would go away and do that. And I think that for lots of people, you know, you talked about Ben Dahmer, I don't know that, but strong characters need to succeed. As Eddie said, you know, if you've been given everything and you have everything, then you don't necessarily want to fight and push through that. And I might have come back for a privileged background, but I had a chip on my shoulder. I wanted to perform. And, you know, all you had to do was wind me up and go through, but also back me. And that was the difference. So when Eddie came in, he would have a meeting and he'd say, we'd have a laugh. He'd say, "Hask, anything to say?" And it wasn't, you know, make the lads laugh or be the clown. It was like, what do you think? Count my experience. And that, I felt, fucking hell, this guy wants to know what I want to do. And he'd say, he'd walk past me and say, "Mate, do you know how good you could be? Do you know what you could do? This is, you know, do you know how physical you are? I don't want you to think too much. I want you to do this. The media are going to say this when I play you seven, but just fucking go and do this. Ask Steve, speak to Paul Gustard. These guys will help." And that, it changed my career. And everyone says, "You played the best rugby." And I said, because the guy understood how I did it and provided an environment where the first week of working with Eddie, I joked with Eddie. Eddie said to me, how are you? Like, what's the, I said, "Eddie, I'm really good, but I'm a bit nervous because I've not ever seen you fucking shout at anyone yet." And Eddie just said to me, "I don't know if he remembers." He goes, "That's old Eddie, mate. That's old Eddie. This is new Eddie." So I was like, I was like, this is brilliant. And we sat down as a senior team. So the week after the Scotland game, we sat down at Penny Hill Park and we turned around to each other, me, Marla, Ben Youngs, Mike Brown, Dylan, Danny Kerr, Owen, and we went, "How fucking good is this?" I remember Ben Young saying, going, "I bet you wish you'd had this the whole time, Hask." I went, "Yeah." And I went, "Would you give up some caps to have had this?" And I said, "I'd fucking give up all the caps I had to just be in this environment, because it was everything that England should be. And yes, you can always get better. Yes, you can always improve. We can all do more stuff. But for the first time, when you drove through the gates of Penny Hill Park, you were like, fuck yes, I'm here to work. I know that everything I do is going to be thought out, planned. I'm going to be encouraged. It's going to be tough. It's going to be purposeful. No side shit. And we're going to be able to perform." It was addictive. And that's why, you know, when I tried to do everything, because, you know, I wouldn't have, obviously, with the way Sam Hundill and Tom Curry and the way those developed, I'm sure I never would have gone. But it was such a goal, because I knew if any coach I'd ever worked with, when he said we're going to go and win a World Cup,
most people don't have that pedigree, and you don't pay attention. But when Eddie says it, you're like, fucking, yes, sir, let me report for duty and let's crack on.
It's touching, actually, isn't it? Have you had a tribute like that recently?
No, pretty good. There must be something coming after this.
But yeah. I love that. It's really interesting, the relationship that you have with these England players. There's an enormous amount of loyalty. I was actually going to ask you about Billy, actually. And I mean, he's had a lot to say recently. I wondered what you'd made of his comments about, I think he said, I had a real good look at myself. My World Cup wasn't up to scratch. I think I could have been better at the tournament in terms of off the field. I think my head was in the clouds. Did you recognise that at the time, or were you a bit surprised by his self-reflection?
Well, the great thing about Billy is that he's honest, and everyone enjoys his honesty. And I think, like everyone else, he's had a great time to reflect, and I think he's reflected on the period of the World Cup. And I don't think there's anyone at the World Cup that would suggest that Billy didn't give his best. You know, there wouldn't have been a player, staff member who didn't think Billy gave his best, and he did. But he's been reflective. And I think he understands, and I think all of us are feeling this, how much we've missed playing for England and how much gratitude we have to have the opportunity to play for England. And I think that's what he's saying. You know, he wants to go out and he wants to give his best for England going forward. And I think you'll see a number of other players like that because, you know, for a period of time, it's been taken away and no one knew whether it would come back. You know, if you watch the news, I watch BBC World for like 18 hours a day for 7 days a week in Tokyo. So I knew everything that was going on. And, you know, it was pretty grim there for a while, wasn't it? And to have this potential opportunity to play for England again, I think he's saying, I want to make the most of it. And I think that's how a lot of other players are feeling.
The headmaster doesn't always know everything that's going on in the corridors at school, but do you recognise what he's talking about when he says his behaviour wasn't up to scratch? Or is that just sort of deep reflection?
I think it's just deep reflection, mate. And I think it's just saying, you know, I want to do better. I want to do better. And, like, World Cup campaigns are the most fascinating part of coaching because, you know, it's the only time as a national coach you get the team for a period of time where you actually develop the team. You know, other times all you're trying to do is get the team organised. You know, you get them for 5 days before the first test. You're just trying to get them organised, get them on the same page. And you're trying to do little things to develop the team, but at the World Cup, you get 3 months to develop the team, you know, and so you go through, it's like being at the family table, you know, for dinner. You know, you got six people at the family table. Every day that family dinner's different, isn't it? You know, someone's had a good day, someone hasn't had a good day, someone's been in trouble at school, someone's lost their lunchbox, you know, all those sort of conversations. And you get that at a World Cup campaign, so you get these periods of up and down, and you get some periods that are absolutely crucial to bring you tighter together. And sometimes you plan those and sometimes you don't plan them. They just happen. And we had that. It really brings out the character of the players. And Billy certainly had his times during the World Cup. But as I said, there'd be no one that would think that Billy didn't give his best.
I know you've gone into great detail, and I don't want to sort of ask you about on the field because it's been there and done that. But one of the things that was really noticeable being in Japan is how well England almost behaved off the field. I don't mean in terms of behaviour, but there was a real huge support for England in Japan. And I just wanted to ask you almost how proud you were of the players as men as much as what they achieved on the field. And it sort of feels like it's a really good bedrock for the next 4 years.
100%, and it's nice to hear that because when you go to the World Cup, you become more than rugby players. You become ambassadors for your countries, and that's a significant responsibility to take because everyone in Japan at that moment, you know, and there's 120 million Japanese people there, they see England as being the England rugby team. So when a player goes and has coffee down at the local store in Shinjuku, you know, they're seen as representative of the England country, not only England rugby. And I thought our boys were absolutely outstanding. You know, they went out of their way to be engaging. They went out of their way to be, you know, really good role models for the country.
They really did. And it was very noticeable being out there, actually. How excited are you then to get back into it? Do you know what October, November looks like? I know we've got dates in the diary for the end of the Six Nations. Do we know what's coming in terms of this Eight Nations tournament?
Things are changing by the moment, but I think we pretty much know that we'll play the Barbarians, we'll play Italy, and then there will be an Eight Nations, which will feature two other countries, which are still yet to be confirmed. You know, I was just speaking to a mate of mine who's in Australia at the moment, and they were all set to start the rugby championship. And now they've had, I think they've had four cases in New Zealand, which has put everything in, they don't know jeopardy what's going to happen. And we're not sure what's going to happen here, but at this stage, you know, we'll be playing four or five tests in October, November, which is really exciting.
Are you having a regular dialogue with the players, or have you let them get on with it? Or, you know, is the WhatsApp group active or dormant?
In the lockdown, particularly, we had Zoom groups. We had coaches keeping pretty close contact to the players, but now they're flat out with their clubs. You know, they're all training hard, so we've eased off a little bit. But we're starting to get around to the clubs a little bit as the easing of the lockdown takes place. So, but I went up to Leicester last week, and I went to a Starbucks there at 3 o'clock. It closed, so I had to sit outside. So it just goes to show you how things can change so quickly.
Was that for a coffee and a catch-up with Steve? And how's he getting on as a former Bath man and a Saracen now in Tigers colours?
I've had a couple of phone calls with him. No, I think he's really loving it, mate. It's a great opportunity for him now to step forward as a coach. And it's, you know, it's one of the things we set out with Ian Ritchie is to produce some England coaches. So Hats has gone back to Bath, Guzzy's gone to Quinns, and now Steve's at Leicester. And all those three guys are going to do a good job there, not because they've coached with me, but because they're good people and they've had greater experience now. You know, they've experienced club rugby, they've experienced international rugby, and they go back to club rugby now. And Steve will do a great job at Leicester. You know, as Haskell tees, there's no more serious coach in the world than him. I've never met a more analytical man than him.
I think as well, Eddie, it's fair to say, you know, we joked about your lovely wife putting up with you, but I don't think any man in world rugby could have worked as hard as Steve Borthwick worked for you, and also how he's developed. You know, I really think, not taking it anyway, but I think with Eddie, you know, in my first experience, and the fact with the way that Steve worked, he was an incredible coach, you know, Steve, and I think he was instrumental in helping me. You know, he was instrumental on that Lions tour in keeping the midweek team functioning. You know, and I think he's developed into one of the best coaches in the world. And certainly, I think also as a person, I've got so much time for him. And I think when I was very lucky with England, can't talk about the current coaching style because I didn't have an opportunity to work with him, but it was almost a perfect storm of Eddie, Paul Gustard and Steve Borthwick, you know, all complementing personalities, you know, Eddie at the top with a clear vision. Yeah, I couldn't have had more of a fun time with anything. I've got such a soft spot for Steve, and he used to let me tackle him all the time. And if you know Steve, his knees, he's got knees that are like absolutely no cartilage on them. Poor bloke used to carry a bag and he'd be like limping off the field. He'd be like, "Hit me again, Hask." I'd be like, "I'm sorry, Steve." Eddie would be there going, "Hask, hit him." Sorry.
Poor Borthers. In another parallel universe, at this point in time, you'd be on the beach in your Speedos with a pina colada watching Caribbean cricket. Is there any part of you that would be quite... I remember you saying that, I think, almost when you took over with England. Is there any part of you that thinks, I mean, I know we're in the middle of a pandemic, but actually, you know, that wouldn't be too bad right now. Or have you just parked that for another 4 years?
No, excited about coaching England. The opportunity's too good. But I'm looking forward in maybe in 2024 being a coach. They've got a 2020 comp in the West Indies. So maybe
it's going on at the moment, isn't it? Caribbean T20.
Get a job as assistant coach, just fetch the balls, you know, fetch the ball, put the cones out. That'll do me.
I tell you what, genuinely, if I could give you two tickets to an Ashes test or two tickets as a fan to a World Cup final, which one would you go to, rugby?
I just think cricket and test rugby, test cricket and test rugby are the best sports because they're the greatest test of not only your skill, but your physical endeavour, but also your ability to think clearly. And that's why I love them so much. You know, there's such an intense battle in all of those sports and they stand the test of time.
Yeah. In an Ashes test, you support...
The best team.
Splinters, getting some splinters.
I just wanted to ask one question before we go completely off the topic. You know, like you said about keeping in touch with players, is there any players you've had to check in with so when you come back you don't have to worry weigh them on a lorry weighing machine? Anyone that's been, you've been sending messages to going, "Listen, how's that weight?" And they're pretending now you've seen them back at the club and they weigh a fucking ton. I want to know if you've been on anyone for like that.
No, they're pretty good now, mate. The professionalism of the players is incredible. And it's one of the things I think that's stood out in most of the sports. that the players in lockdown have trained incredibly well by themselves. And we say players can't do it by themselves, but they can. And we're looking at changing our Mondays to be much more driven by the players. So have one day where the players work out their own program. So they go to the coaches and say what they need in their groups rather than us tell them what they need. So because they've done it so well during lockdown, you know, I've had 6 or 7 Zoom calls with the clubs, and all of them are raving about how well the players have come back. It's amazing.
Really? Because I suppose that routine of actually, you know, because I spoke to a lot of players that when we had, you know, we spoke to Jack Knoll, who was basically hiding in the gym the whole time so he didn't have to look after the kids, we discovered, and he was, he'd put on more muscle than anyone. But it was interesting that I spoke to Owen, I spoke to Mara, I spoke to a few lads, and because they were able to dictate what they were doing, even though they don't always know best, they felt they were getting the best out of their bodies, knowing the areas they wanted to work on, as opposed to someone with a gun to their head saying, you know, at the club, you've got to do this.
100%. I think the only one that would have been a worry was Dylan. He was still playing. He could have come back a bit pudgy.
I love that.
You'd have given him the right what for. Always good to check in with you on the state of the game right now. I know we've touched on the finances, etc. But are you worried about rugby at the moment?
Look, I think, like most parts of business, we're going through a cycle at the moment, which was an uncontrollable cycle, and we'll get out of it. It will mean that certain parts of the game will struggle for longer. I think staff numbers for professional teams will be smaller, which mightn't be such a bad thing for a period of time, because like a lot of industries, we've gone down the absolute specialisation line where we've got specialists for everything. You know, we've got a specialist for urine testing. We've got a specialist to do the left calf skin fold. We've got a specialist to do the right calf skin fold, and they can't do each other's job, and we'll get more generalists in terms of the staff. And I also think, as I said before, with players, squads will start to build more hybrid players where they can play a number of positions, because if you look at the way the game has gone, it's gone again down the specialist route, and I think we'll get more generalists.
Club v country, is that all right?
Just a constant battle, mate. You know, it's like my dog Annie. You know, she's a little papillon. She's about 4 Ks. We were out having lunch today, and this chow chow. Have you seen a chow chow? They look like Macca coming at you. You know, they're about 30, 35 Ks, and they've got no expression on their face. They just look at you. So Annie just fires up and goes at him. And, you know, she's going to get eaten.
Yeah.
But she has a go. And it's the same with the clubs in the country. It's always going to be the case in England. And that's the way it is. And maybe that's healthy for the game, that there's so much conflict that keeps everyone on their toes.
Dare I ask which one of the two is the chow chow, or is that reader to decide?
That's for the readers to work out, mate.
Right, okay.
Eddie, do you find it... I know it's a difficult subject. You said at the show, I'm not going to get into... ask you to do too political stuff. But some countries, for example, like New Zealand, this is my assessment of it, is obviously a lot of Super Rugby sides, you know, everything they do is about helping the New Zealand be the best team. They have centralised training plans. They play in similar styles, which helps the All Blacks. You know, with England, you know, obviously you've got, you know, 12 different teams pulling in different directions. And certainly before your time, even when I was with other England coaches, there was always that constant battle to get the best for the players, the best for the clubs. You know, I would sometimes come back to my club and they would be like, we've got this from England, but we're not going to fucking do it. You know, or because people would get, it was almost that arrogance sometimes. And I'm not saying for you to comment necessarily too much on it, but do you think it would be better for the national team to have much more of a unified approach and better communications? Or do you think, in what you just said, a competition is actually a bit easier?
What you need is a strong domestic competition. Doesn't matter what country you are, you need a strong domestic competition. In New Zealand, they're provincial people. Provinces fight each other. And you know, like the South Island battle between Canterbury and the Highlanders is massive. Canterbury and Otago, they don't like each other. So that drives the whole of their rugby. And then that filters through to the All Blacks. Now, what they've been able to do because of the economics there is they've been able to keep that rivalry but join it together for the good of the All Blacks, whereas in England we've got privately owned clubs, which is the sporting background in England, isn't it? You know, apart from Olympic sports, every other sport is about privately owned clubs, and relegation and promotion's huge, isn't it? You know, it's a huge part of the sporting mentality here. And I think if we were to take those battles away, you'd lose some of the good of the domestic. And at the international level, all we can do is try to be as dogmatic about certain things and accommodating in other areas. And that's how we've tried to be, you know, whether it's worked or not. You know, I'm sure there's a number of different views on that.
I can just feel someone is cleaning the naughty step here, and I don't want to push you any closer towards it. So we'll move on. Have you spoken to the Saris boys? And how on earth are you going to play the next 12 months for some of the key characters in your setup?
Well, I think for a lot of those boys, you know, they're the guys that have been playing consistently since 2015 World Cup. They've been on the train that never comes off the track, and now they've got a chance to stop at a few stations, get a refuel. Get the inside renovated. So it's a massive opportunity for those players to be in their best condition. And I'm so excited about it for them. The players that struggle the most at the moment are the guys with the top clubs that play in the finals of the Premiership, play in the finals of Europe, start for England, and then potentially go on the Lions Tour. They're the guys that are playing the 30-plus games. For the rest of the players, it's a tough, long season, but they're generally not playing any more games than anywhere else in the world. So for those guys, and a lot of those guys have been at Saris, they're the guys now that have got an opportunity to refuel. So they're only going to benefit from it.
Will you be making the journey to the Menai Field in Cornwall to watch Saracens against the Cornish Pirates? And which of those Saris boys are most going to struggle with getting changed in a portaloo and running out through sort of, you know, clearing the dog mess off the pitch before? Who will most embrace it at Saracens and who will struggle with it the most?
I think Owen will love it, mate. I can see him kicking goals from 70 metres against the Jersey Reds. Hey?
In a hurricane. I can imagine.
I think Morrow's, you know, went to Harrow. He's a bit, he likes to have his entourage with him, so maybe he might struggle a bit, but he's a good fella. He'll be all right.
He'll be all right. And what about Owen and Morrow going to play with the Chiefs? I saw some stuff that maybe Warren Gatlin might get them down there for a bit of Super Rugby. Would you be all for that?
Yeah, no, if the club's accommodating, they could get a 5 or 6 week stint down there. It'd be great for them. At the moment, the Chiefs probably need a little bit of influx of talent. They're doing it tougher. And it just shows you how tough that competition is. You know, again, Hass, you've experienced. Imagine playing that competition where you don't get any respite at all. Like, every game's like an all-black trial. And it's been fascinating to see how the players have stepped up from not a great preparation to play at the level they've played. It's a tribute to the players again, and it shows you how great a game we've got when the players can play such a high quality rugby.
How will Gats be handling this task, knowing him as you do?
I think it'll be, you know, he obviously has almost had a bit of a rarefied career for a long period of time. Obviously, well deserved, because he is a good coach. But you know, obviously, I think it'd be very tough for him to adjust that, because you know, most things he's touched, you know, have turned to gold or near enough gold, or he's had those opportunities. And I think, you know, the first time when he went back to Waikato, they did very well. And then I think coming back, you know, the intensity and I think, look, you know, because he's in New Zealand and he's done stuff so well before, I know the New Zealand media can be tricky, but I think it would have been way more difficult if he'd been over here and taken over a Premiership side. I think no one would have let him forget it. I think, you know, he's a quality coach. And I think the fact is, as Eddie said, when you're playing against the quality of opposition and the high-speed nature of those games, the intensity, you know, I think some of, you know, I always maintain that, you know, playing against New Zealand sides is physical, and I think they're individually very good athletes with all-round skill sets, but it's not like playing in South Africa or not like playing in the Premiership. Sometimes you watch some of the defensive bits, some of it, and you kind of think, you know, they know they're going to score another try, so there's not quite the intensity. But, you know, I think that, you know, Chiefs are a quality side. And I think any other side, any other time they would have won. So I think he'll be very disappointed. But if anyone can sort of regroup, I know Warren can. I've seen some stupid bits in the media talk about coaching the Lions and whether he should do that. But it's just a load of crap for me. I think it's two different things, two different situations and two different bits of time. And, you know, his pedigree with the Lions speaks for itself, really.
That might be an application for Hass for the assistant team manager as well for the Lions.
Actually, I think Kitman. We'll leave him at Kitman only. He can take off
questions.
In a professional development for Gary.
Yeah, I tell you what. I've got two questions. I wonder if Eddie, we said at the start with coaches' communication, whether you've been sending anything to Warren, any joking bits, stuff like that, winding him up just for purely for shits and giggles. And
also, have you popped anything over, Eddie? Have you done a little meme?
Or Haven't got his New Zealand number, mate. I feel for him. He'll be right. It's just been a difficult time. They've been caught on the hop, and I'm sure you watch the games. You know, there's been one or two plays in each game. Goes the other way, the ball bounces the other way, the touch judge puts his flag up and they win the games. And you go through those seasons sometimes, and sometimes those seasons are the most important seasons in your coaching career because you learn so much from it, as painful as they are.
Lots of people talking up the Crusaders at the moment as well, in terms of, you know, the domination that they've got in Super Rugby. Crusaders Saracens, Crusaders Leinster. Who wins in Dubai on a cool summer's evening, neutral venue?
Who's the referee?
You pick the referee.
Nigel Owens.
No, I could say something, but I might get in trouble there.
You are always flirting with that naughty step, just hovering your foot over it.
Definitely Wayne Barnes, mate. He's gonna referee till he's 60. He'll be the first referee at the World Cup at 60, and he'll get the World Cup final at 60. He'll keep going, mate. Well.
Who wins the game?
If it's a referee that allows quick ball consistently, which Wayne would, then the Crusaders will win. If there's a bit of mucky ball, then Leinster or Saracens will win.
Interesting. It would be a great watch, that.
It would be.
Let's make it happen. Eddie, it's been an absolute privilege and a pleasure. Just before we go, actually, I want to ask you some quick fire questions as well, but what's on the to-do list for the next week, 2 weeks? Are you getting out on the paddle board and some downtime, or are you now putting the foot down on the accelerator?
On the road, mate, on the road. The next 10 weeks, 3 games a week, and then we've got midweek games coming up. So looking forward to seeing some live rugby. It'll be really good to see how the players come back. And I'm really interested to see what teams go forward in this period and what team goes backwards. And with that, the fortune of the players, because obviously we're going to select the squad of 32. And it's going to be an important squad for us to pick, because we've got the Italian game, which is going to be the most important game we play this year.
How much of that 32 do you know right now?
Well, you know, we have constant selection meetings because it's the most important part of the job. So we might know 28, but sport has shown that generally post-corona, there's been a fair few injuries. And just with this weather at the moment, the grounds are going to be hard, which could exacerbate the injury. So we need to be prepared for a number of players that maybe might get injured. No one wishes that, but that might happen. So it's a bit of a waiting game.
I weighed in 128.8 kgs 2 days ago. So if you like a prop, I can make a comeback. I won't be able to run anywhere, but I'll be quite good at the scrum and maybe the post-match speech.
You're like a bloody roundabout, Hask.
He looks a bit like, you remember that American prop, Eric Fry?
Yes.
Yeah. That's
just
a bit like him.
Unbelievable.
Someone actually, one of our viewers wrote in with one of the questions. It's the guy from the guy called the Good Reverend. He said, "Why hasn't Hass been employed as team and morale manager yet, Quint Eddie?" That's the fucking question I've been asking my entire life. Why I haven't had the call to get in the mix? Because I tell you what, if you're going to be on the road for 10 weeks, surely you need a driver, morale man. My house is always open. Starbucks closed at 3. Haskey and Palace is open 24 hours a day.
Oh, best green tea in Daventry for sure.
That is very true.
Stick a blue plaque on the wall for that. Right, Eddie, just before we go, quick five questions. We've done a bit of borrowing from a fabulous French TV show called We On De Culture. There's absolutely no culture coming from Hass, Tins or I. So it's essentially a little pop quiz. Shoot from the lip, if you will. What is your favourite word?
Yes.
Your least favourite word?
No.
Greatest moment in the game?
Coming.
Your worst moment in the game?
Can't remember.
Favourite swear word?
I've got a few, mate.
What sound or noise do you love?
Annie's tail wagging.
Sound or noise that you hate?
Particularly since I don't drink much now, drunks late at night.
I can imagine. And at train stations as well, I'd imagine as well. What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
I'd love to be a sporting director at a big public school like the one Hass went to.
Oh, my God. Imagine trying to keep him out of trouble. If you could do a road trip with 3 players that you coached, who'd be in the car?
Definitely Hask, Dylan, and maybe Joe Marler.
Very good. That'd be a lot of fun. I've got to ask you about Matt Gitto as well, very quickly, who we had on the other day, who does a very good impression of you and does the most fabulous story about Champ. Gitz, is he on the Christmas card list? Have you seen him recently? He very much portrayed a headmaster, sort of junior member at school relationship with you.
It was funny. Well, he ended up playing for Suntory in Japan, who I had a long relationship with, so I saw him a few times there. I'm really pleased how he's matured as a player. What a great career he had. You know, and he speaks fondly of his time playing with Johnny at Toulon. You know, and even at Suntory at 37, he was the hardest training player there, played every game like it was a test match. It's a real tribute to him. He's a funny little bugger as well.
Sums it up perfectly. Final question. If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Well done.
Pasts in hell. Fucking yeah.
What a note on what to end. On which to end. Eddie, you're a star. It's been an absolute privilege and a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for gracing our new Good, Bad and Rugby podcast. And we wish you all the very best for the coming weeks and months. It's going to be a lot of fun, I know. Look after yourself. Look after Annie. Look after Mrs. Jones as well. And we'll see you on a touchline before too long.
Ladies
and gents, that is it for this week. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening to The Good, The Bad and The Rugby. We are off and running with an absolute superstar. Please do subscribe on YouTube and wherever it is that you get your podcasts. Just type in Good, Bad and Rugby. Do leave us a review as well, preferably a positive one, and preferably one where you're reviewing the show, not the trailer. I'm sure you know that those things always help. Do get involved across our social media pages as well. Look out for the boys on TV and radio for the rest of the week on our little promotional tour. God help the presenters involved with that. Best of luck to them. A quick reminder of the live rugby this weekend. It's back. BT Sport, Friday night, 7:45. Quins against Sale gets you up and running. I think we've got every game available to watch on BT in the coming months. And the final round of Super Rugby Aotearoa is on Sky Sports this weekend, God willing. Hopefully the COVID situation there will stay under control. Blues against the champion Crusaders at a sold-out Eden Park on Sunday, the pick of the games. Thank you once again to Eddie. Look after yourself. What a privilege and a pleasure. Thank you to Tins. Thank you to Hask. We'll be back next week with another huge guest. Take it away, Rob Brydon, but from all of us, bye for now.
Thank you so much for listening to The Good, The Bad and The Rugby. It can't have been easy.